from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In Hasidism, A New History, David Beal takes on the many myths about the Orthodox Jewish sect.
The book is, in a sense, written against some of the prevailing views of Hasidism.
The book lays out a case that Hasidism was not actually in decline during the 19th century, as previous scholars have suggested, and it offers fresh insights into the life and work of the man credited as the movement's founder. We'll also get Professor Beal's thoughts on why Hasidism thrives today and the challenges facing those who choose to leave the community. That's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The eight authors of Hasidism, A New History, provide a comprehensive look at the traditions and influence of the Orthodox Jewish sect that began in the 18th century. Years of research led them to part with some myths about the pietistic movement, such as its supposed 19th century decline. And the book also provides fresh insights into the life of the Baal Shem Tov, who is often credited as the movement's founder. David Beal, one of the authors and a professor of Jewish history at UC Davis, joins me this hour in studio, and we're going to discuss the origins of Hasidism, its influence on Judaism, and how Hasidism manages to thrive today. And welcome, David Beal.
Thanks very much.
Glad to have you here. And we should say, starting out here, that you don't see that many Hasids in Northern California. When they're seen, they're often mistaken for the Amish, right?
Well, actually, there aren't that many. The one group that is represented here is Chabad or Lubavitch. They have houses in different places in the Bay Area as well as throughout the world. But they are really unique in a sense. They are a missionizing group. Most Hasidic groups are not missionizing. And so they're found sort of in their local habitats, which are in Brooklyn and in Israel.
And the proselytizers are mainly the Lubavitchers.
Yes, that's correct, because that's actually a product of the seventh Rebbe, as the leaders are called, of Lubavitch, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who died in 1994.
They still believe he's going to be resurrected, though.
Some of them do, yeah. Some of them do. And his approach was actually a kind of a evangelical or missionizing approach, where he encouraged his followers to go out and to proselytize among secular Jews. And they've been reasonably successful at that.
They managed the Hasidism generally to keep away from secularism to a great degree. In fact, Hasidism, we should say, means piety, and these disciples of different rebbes go ahead and try to not only sort of spread the word almost in an evangelical way, well, it is an evangelical way in the strict meaning of the word evangelicalism, but explain something to me, because I teased this in the last hour. Maybe you can shed some light on this. About 25% of American Jews voted for Donald Trump, but almost 100%, I mean, really probably close to 100% of Hasidim Jews voted for Trump.
Yes, that seems to be correct. In this sense, they are not actually different from other Orthodox Jews. Hasidism is a subset among Orthodox Jews, which has a sort of a spectrum of belief and practice. But Orthodox Jews, generally speaking, it seems, did vote overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. And in this sense, they resemble evangelical Christian voters, which, of course, that's a conundrum. Why people of that sort, with that religious belief, would vote for somebody so patently anti-religious or non-religious.
But a lot of it has to do with the fact that, like a lot of the evangelicals, and particularly like Catholics, they don't believe in birth control, they don't believe in abortion. I mean, some of those really cross over.
That is correct. And that's actually one of the fascinating things, that here is a movement that arose within the Jewish world that distinguished itself very sharply from the non-Jewish world. I mean, sometimes in virtual racial terms. And yet today, at least in their political behavior, they see the non-Jewish, the Christian evangelical world as a kind of ally.
And they're such tight communities. I mean, there's been a lot of light shed on some of the abuses that have existed because of the community staying so closed. And wanting to protect those who are guilty of domestic abuse, guilty of sexual abuse, and so forth. And in fact, that community is so tight that now there's a lot of fascination with the tightness of the communities. There's a 2017 documentary feature film that chronicles the life of three ex-Hasidic Jews from Brooklyn. Many of you might have seen it. It's on Netflix. In fact, if you have, we would be certainly interested in hearing your thoughts about it. But here's a clip of one of them from the trailer.
I was living a double life for a little over a year. I called my mom and I said, hey, mom, can I talk to you? She's like, yeah. I was like, are you sitting down? And I said, I'm not religious anymore. She said, okay. Then she just hung up. And then we didn't speak for 7 years.
Whew. Lots of stories like that out of Hasidim.
There are a lot of stories like that. I mean, I should add that in that film, a different story that they
which
follow,
I should add, you were an advisor.
Yeah, I was an advisor on the film. There's a different story, a story about another young man who's leaving the Hasidic world, and he becomes a kind of drug addict. What's interesting, and it's not actually developed in the film, is that his father supports his rehab. So it's not necessarily always the case that because someone becomes non-religious that their families cut them off totally. I mean, there are many stories like that. There's a very fine memoir by an ex-Hasidic guy named Shulam Dean called All Who Go Do Not Return. And he chronicles how he couldn't see his children, and he was totally cut off from his children. That is not uncommon for people who leave if they have children.
That was what I was trying to get at in terms of the tightness of the community.
Yes.
And it's more for the Satmars than it is for the Lubavitchers. I want to make this binary.
Yeah, I think Lubavitch is very unusual. And when people think about Hasidism, they usually think about Lubavitch because they see those people in their community, since they have these Chabad houses everywhere. But they really are kind of outliers. They are much more comfortable with the modern world. They use the internet much more. They know how to talk to secular people. So they're actually quite different. And I think they're probably people who leave would face less obstacles than some of the other groups. Like you mentioned Satmar, which is, in fact, the largest Hasidic group in the world. People often have the misimpression that Chabad is very large because you see them missionizing. But in fact, they're a relatively small group. Satmar, much bigger. There may be over 100,000 Satmar Hasidim. Mostly located in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, also in Israel. There are other very large groups. They're generally not well known because they tend to be more insular.
How many Hasidim are there now globally?
We estimate, and it is an estimate based on sort of extrapolation from demographic data, that they're probably close to 750,000 out of maybe 13 million Jews in the world. So it's a very significant minority in the Jewish world. The most interesting question is, how did they grow to such enormous numbers when by the end of the Holocaust, there were almost none left? And that's a fascinating story that we try to chronicle in the book.
Which you do chronicle, and you chronicle the ups and downs of Hasidism and some of the misinterpretations of the evolution of Hasidism. But let's talk about Hasidism in general, and I want to get at the roots of it with you and the history of it. I mean, Martin Buber, famous Jewish existentialist writer, I and Thou and so forth, said it was Kabbalah become ethos, which is sort of a great abbreviated analysis of what it is. Kabbalah, of course, being the mystical Jewish text, and become ethos, become a way of life and tied to Orthodoxy mainly, yeah?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the 18th century, when Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, was sort of elite doctrine, was not generally known by the masses. Hasidism plays the role of popularizing these teachings, of turning.
It's like a populist movement.
It was a populist movement, absolutely. It didn't start that way, and I think this is a very important part of our argument. People think of Israel Baal Shem Tov, the so-called founder of Hasidism, as founding a populist revolt against the rabbis. We say that's not correct. He actually was not some kind of outsider. He was a a functionary of his Jewish community. He lived in a communal building that was given to him tax-free. And he was, what was his role? He was called, and we found this on the tax rolls of his community, Dr. Baal Shem, Kabbalist, which means he was a magician. He wrote amulets for people who were ill or had some other difficulties, and it was a common way in not only among Jews, but among Poles generally of the time, use of these magical formulas.
He was sort of a wizard and a miracle doer.
Yes, he was. But he was part of the establishment. As far as we can determine, he did not set out to found a movement. He had a circle of contemporaries, maybe disciples. It's hard to know how to categorize them. It's really only a generation and a half later. He dies in 1760, and it's really only after 1772 when one of his main disciples, the so-called Dov Ber, the Magid of Mezrich, dies, that his disciples go out and found a movement. So it only emerges as a movement fairly late, and it's still probably relatively elite. Attracts, you know, learned boys, probably young men. And then it becomes only a true mass movement, a populist movement in the 19th century. So in a way, there's a kind of optical illusion in which scholars like Martin Buber thought that Hasidism was a mass populist movement in the 18th century. It was not. It only becomes that about 100 years later.
And the part of that movement that became dynastic with courts and all the rest of it, with leading rabbis, didn't happen till later, really, also.
That's correct. The dynastic principle, even though there's some evidence of it in the 18th century, really gets established in the early 19th century. That is, that these wonder-working rabbis, these charismatic figures who have followers, they begin to establish courts, and they actually call them courts. They resemble quite deliberately, in some cases, the Polish nobility. They have kind of opulent houses, opulent synagogues, and they then pass on their rule usually to their oldest son. And that dynastic principle then becomes established as part of what distinguishes Hasidism.
Talking with David Beal, he is co-author of Hasidism, A New History, and he's a professor of Jewish history and director of the Jewish Studies Program at UC Davis. There were a number of scholars who worked on this book collectively. There's a joke in there about, you know, how do that many Jews get along and how they work together and so forth, but it worked out okay, obviously.
Yeah, it was a remarkable process. I was actually drafted into the project. There was a group that had formed before I joined it. They needed someone who kind of organize. And my idea was that we don't write an encyclopedia. We don't write a anthology of essays with different people's names on the chapters. Instead, we write a collectively authored book. And the reason for that is that Hasidism, even though it is a movement, it's actually a movement of movements. There are many, many different courts, many different groups. We don't call them sects, by the way. Many different groups. And in order to encompass this history, which goes on for about 250 years, you need a group of scholars with expertise in different areas. So what we did is we got a number of very fine grants, and we sat actually in Leipzig, Germany, of all places, for 4 summers, and we wrote together. And it was one of the best experiences of my life. You know, people speak of scholars as being completely isolated from each other, working in their ivory towers. We were able to break through that and actually work together. And we even ended up friends. So it was a remarkable experience.
Yes, indeed, it sounds like a remarkable experience. The irony of being in Leipzig, of all places, too. I mean, in Germany.
I can explain that, by the way.
Yeah.
There is an institute in Germany. In Leipzig, called the Simon Dubnow Institute. Now, Simon Dubnow was the first historian of Hasidism. He published a book in 1931 called History of Hasidism in Hebrew and in German. It's not actually available in English. And
he was really for many years the leading light historically.
He was. Yeah. He was. I mean, he started this project in the 1880s in Russia. He wrote articles in Russian. He had to flee Russia in the 1920s, came to Berlin. Then he fled to Riga, and he was actually murdered by the Nazis in 1941. He was a great historian, the founding historian, really, of East European Jewish history. There were some German scholars in the 1990s who decided to found an institute using his name. So for us, it was an entirely appropriate place to be because it was it has his name on it, and we see him as the founding historian of the history of Hasidism, even as we go beyond him and revise him.
But if you were, I mean, it sounds a bit reductive, but if you were to talk about really what really defines Hasidism, aside from the fact that they resisted secularism and still resist secularism, a lot of it had to do with the theology that was based more on sort of apprehending or experiencing God in a different way than studying the texts and looking at Talmud, Torah, all that. It was more often feeling God through the senses and through the body and being ecstatic. And it's mystical, really.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there are two things that distinguish Hasidism from other Jewish movements. The first is the social structure that I spoke about before, these courts, the Hasidim, which, by the way, it means pious, but in the movement, it comes to mean followers. You are a Hasid of a particular Rebbe. So it has that social structure. These followers can live dispersed. They're not in the same town as the leader. They make pilgrimage to his court. So there's that social structure.
And excuse me, some of these Rebbes, of course, were brilliant and men of great wisdom, always men. And some of them were charlatans and crooks and, you know, there was a whole range.
Who are crooks, right? And we can talk about them because those are interesting stories too. But I want to come back to your point, which is the theological innovation of Hasidism. And I think the thought of this movement is very, very important. It's not just the social structure. This is a movement that teaches that God is everywhere in the world.
It's pantheism.
It's close to pantheism. It depends on which Hasidic teacher you're following, but it's often close to pantheism. You worship God through everything. You worship God through the bread that you eat, through, as Martin Buber tells this great story that actually has Hasidic roots, that people came to the Rebbe not to listen to his teachings, but to watch him tie his shoes. That is, in the everyday actions, you could find holiness. And I think this is a crucial part of Hasidism. The Baal Shem Tov rebelled against the dominant culture of his time by teaching that you don't worship God through asceticism, through tormenting your body.
Or denying your body.
You're denying your body. You worship God through joy and through the material world. This is a major innovation. Now, not every Hasidic teacher adheres to this. There are some who are extremely ascetic, who rebel against the idea. They return really to the older form of piety that is very ascetic or anti-material. But this is a major innovation of Hasidism, and so worshiping God through dance, through song. This is very, very important part of the movement and distinguishes it really. And in a way, this is Hasidism's innovation. Hasidism claims to be a traditional movement. And people think, oh, this is how Jews lived for thousands of years. Not so. It is a very innovative movement. All of these kind of behaviors are new and are unprecedented.
But there was a sense of, as you indicated earlier, of a kind of revival after the Holocaust.
Yes.
I mean, despite the almost decimation of Hasids who were particularly in Eastern Europe and Germany and so forth. Yeah.
Well, they were in Eastern Europe, and because the Jewish populations of Eastern European countries, Poland, Russia, the Baltic states, Hungary, because most of the Jews there were murdered, this, of course, included Hasidim as well. They, too, suffered enormously high death rates. I actually wrote the chapter at Hasidism and the Holocaust, and I found it fascinating because we normally think of the Hasidim as being very passive, otherworldly. I actually discovered that in response to the Nazis, they mobilized tremendous resources because they had these sort of geographical networks. They were able to mobilize the network to protect Hasidim, and particularly their leaders, and to save them. So this is actually a fascinating part of the story. But most of the Hasidim themselves died in the Holocaust. After the war, a number of the leaders survived, and they then begin to rebuild. And they do so in really a very dramatic way. They recruit other Jews who are not Hasidim, but they may be traditional survivors in many cases. They recruit them into the movement. And then once they establish a kind of a base, then natural increase takes over. These are people who have 10 or 15 children, and especially in the modern world with public health and medicine, they are able to have very, very large families. And so much of the increase that we spoke of earlier takes place as a result of natural increase.
And here in the United States, particularly, with all those children, there's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of,
yes.
And certainly a great deal of welfare, social welfare. And this is also something that has brought a lot of criticism onto Hasidism, the fact that, there are many political arguments that go back and forth about this, but the fact that many of them are uneducated in the secular world. I mean, and this is true as true in the United States as it is in Israel. They're kept pretty much confined to studying Talmud and Torah and the like, and they can't find their way into the normal economy, so they become more dependent on the state economy.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, one of the explanations for Hasidism's success in the post-World War II world is that they've been able to benefit from the welfare state. Both in America and in Israel and in other countries where they're represented in smaller numbers. In America, they tend much more to work than they do in Israel. So they are involved, while they don't have secular education, they are involved in the business world. For example, the Diamond District in New York is heavily Hasidic, as it is in Antwerp and in Belgium. In Israel, a different kind of process took place where virtually all of them continue to study even after they marry, and they are supported by the welfare state. Now, there's been moves in Israel to try to encourage them to join the economy, and there have been some success in this, particularly among Hasidic women, who tend to get more of a secular education than the men, and they then tend to move into the economy more than the men do.
But we should mention this has always been a patriarchal form of religion and certainly has been hegemonic, where men are concerned to fight, despite the fact that, you know, women do play a central role in terms of the home and bringing in the Sabbath and all the rest of that. It's pretty much locked into kind of a male patriarchy.
That's true, although I would qualify that somewhat. I mean, we deal with this question. It's a very fascinating question. Were women Hasidim in the 18th and 19th century? And the answer seems to be no. There was a Hasid, and then there was his wife, and she would define herself as a wife of a Hasid rather than a Hasid, or in Hebrew would be Hasida, herself.
Well, we mentioned the Netflix film, and there's a portrait of a woman named Eddie, which is very powerful. And that, if you saw that film, we'd like to hear your thoughts about it. Or if you have questions or comments about Hasidism, we invite you to join us. We're talking to David Beal, who is co-author of Hasidism, A New History, and professor of Jewish history and director of Jewish studies at UC Davis. You're welcome to join the program. Our toll-free number available right now. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us at that number. Please do. 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments about the Hasidim movement, its history, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Please feel free to join the program. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. Our guest this hour, David Beal, here in studio with us, co-author of Hasidism, A New History, and he's professor of Jewish history and director of the Jewish Studies program at UC Davis, a book that was done with a number of scholars. And if you have questions or comments about Hasidism, we certainly would be interested in hearing from you. You can join us at our toll-free number. That number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. And we should say, David, that here in the United States, there was for a while a belief that Hasidism, because the communities were so close-knit and cloistered, really, that and following the Rebbe's rules to a great degree, that there was very little violation of the law or law-breaking, that there was little in the way of the kind of problems that we're rife with, narcotics addiction and so forth in secular society. This is being dispelled somewhat lately. I mean, these are isolated cases, but isolated cases of dreadful kind of domestic abuse and rape and things like that, that the Rebbe's essentially kind of herded everybody around not to report to the local authorities. The other thing I think that needs to be considered here is the power politically that Hasids have had in certain boroughs and districts, especially in the East Coast, because their numbers. It was, you know, I don't, some may find this a distasteful analogy, but Jim Jones had a lot of people who went to the polls. That was a cult. Hasidism is seen as a cult, and let's go right to that. I mean, the political power of what may indeed in many people's eyes be a cult.
Yes, well, I mean, I think it's not a cult in that we normally think of a cult as around a central figure who has sort of criminal behavior, you know, sleeps with all the women and so forth. I mean, Hasidism doesn't really fit into that kind of model. These are indeed tight-knit communities. They follow the lead of their charismatic Rebbe, their leader. And it is true that they generally tend to vote as a bloc. So therefore, politicians will go and meet with them, hoping to get, you know, their endorsement because it brings with it a lot of votes. You know, I think
keeping them out of public schools, it turned out, in one area, for example, or keeping that is secularism from coming into.
Well, this is actually a very difficult and big issue. The Hasidic communities of Brooklyn are, you know, outgrowing their housing in those areas. And so already quite a few decades ago, the leader of the Satmar Hasidim founded a village in upstate New York called Kiryas Yoel. His name was Yoel Teitelbaum. And there have been other such villages established in upstate. And this has led to some very serious legal conflicts. So Kiryas Yoel actually wanted to establish its own school system so it could get from public public funds support for disabled students. And this led to actually a Supreme Court case. More recently, there was a case in a place called Bloomingburg in upstate New York where the Hasidim decided to establish a community of about 420 housing units, and they were accused by the federal government of a voter fraud, that is, of busing people in to vote in the local election so they could take over the local community. And the developer and his partner were pled guilty and were sentenced to prison, as was a their Satmar liaison. So these are very serious, difficult issues. That is, you know, people should be allowed to live where they want. On the other hand, local communities don't want to be taken over by a religious group that has its own practices. So these are difficult questions for our democracy.
Maybe one of the most difficult questions about Hasidism, when you see God in everything and God is immanent and sort of, like you said before, borders on pantheism. What do they do about evil? What do they do about, you know, criminality and those kinds of things?
Well, I mean, they recognize that. It's, you know, I should emphasize this idea of pantheism, which was very dominant in the 18th century. Today, most Hasidic groups are not particularly mystical. They don't draw upon these mystical roots very deeply. Yes, there's a belief that God is everywhere, and we can worship God in our daily lives. But that, of course, does not you know, eliminate the problem of evil. I mean, there evil still exists, and people can be evil, and the communities recognize this. I think that the issue that you raised before about domestic abuse and so on. There's a long tradition in Judaism. It goes back long before Hasidism that you do not take your legal disputes to secular courts. And so they try to resist this. They try to deal with these problems internally. And this has not always led to good results for the victims of abuse. So this is a serious issue, I think.
Yeah, in fact, Ben, one of our listeners says, can your guest discuss the potential for family and sexual abuse in these communities? Because traditional law enforcement is not used and people who call the police are shunned.
True enough, but I want to emphasize, and this is a point for those who have seen this documentary, One of Us, that I think is underplayed in the documentary. It's not as if these communities paper over such domestic abuse. If it comes to light, they do have ways of dealing with it internally. They do not ignore it. And I think that the particular cases that come to light in this film are when people try to go outside of the local or the community's way of enforcement. I mean, this is not to say that the community always deals with these things correctly.
No, in fact, one would assume that in many cases they don't because it's so hierarchical in its structure. And if someone, for example, is guilty of sexual abuse or domestic abuse and is high up in that hierarchy, there's a tendency perhaps to let things go.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that. I think that, you know, I don't think this is as well researched as it ought to be.
I agree with you on that.
I think they do recognize the potential of domestic abuse. And, of course, divorce is part of Jewish law. It's not a problem to divorce, actually very easy. And if a woman brings a divorce...
Easy for chassids to divorce?
It's not. It's easy, legally speaking, within the community. However, the problem is that a man has to bring the divorce action. It's more difficult if a woman wants to bring it, but there are mechanisms for women doing that. And I think what we need to try to learn about is how often does that happen? These are communities that recognize that marriages are not always, you know, irenic. And so there are mechanisms within the community, but there are also cases where they kind of, you know, sweep it under the rug and where secular authorities need to step in.
Depends who the Rebbe is, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yes.
Let me get to our callers. And let's begin with a caller from Pacifica. Steve, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Thanks. So I was just thinking somebody could write a book about the similarities between the Amish and the Hasidic Jews. But my question really has to do with what is the relationship between the Hasidic Jews and secular Jews and with Christians?
So those are all great questions. I mean, first of all, to treat the Amish question, yeah, there's a tendency to see them as similar to the Amish. They actually aren't. First of all, the Amish tend to be rural. Hasidim, at least since World War I, have increasingly been urban, and today they are primarily urban. So this is something very different. They actually, you know, those who do work within the modern economy in certain branches of the economy. So they're actually quite different from the Amish. The Amish also do not use technology from later than the mid-19th century. The Hasidim generally do not have a problem with using modern technology, with the exception of the Internet. They're very scared of the Internet because primarily of sexuality. And so they try to put a lid on the use of the Internet.
But like most observant and Orthodox Jews, they don't use any technology or anything even resembling technology on Shabbos.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. So they're, you know, one day in the week, they do not use anything that might be construed as igniting a fire, which is also using electricity. In terms of their relationship to secular Jews, so Hasidism from sometime in the latter part of the 19th century begins to see itself as the bulwark of orthodoxy against modern secularism. This is something relatively new. It does not define itself that way at the outset. And today they very much see the secular world as their enemy. They use tools from the secular world to resist that world, for example, political organizing, the press, and so forth. They use these kind of modern tools, but they see themselves as really the antithesis of the secular world. With respect to the Christian world...
Let me just read a comment for that, to respect, because I think it's important. Edna writes, please clarify for non-Jewish listeners that Lubavitch proselytized to less observant or secular Jews, but not non-Jews.
That is correct, and thank you for that. They are not interested in non-Jews becoming Jews. Although, interestingly, The seventh Rebbe of Lubavitch, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who started this missionizing campaign, also started a campaign to encourage non-Jews to become what are called Noahites. There are, in Jewish tradition, something called the seven laws of the sons of Noah. And those laws, which are kind of, you know, you shouldn't murder, steal, and so forth, he believed that if non-Jews adhered to those laws, they would contribute to the coming of the Messianic Age. So they do not proselytize among non-Jews to become Jews, but they do proselytize among them to become Noahites.
The Hasid movement has a lot of messianic roots in it. I mean, going back to Shabbatai Zvi, right, who is the false messiah or deemed to be the false messiah. Also Schneerson, whom we mentioned, and so forth. There's a whole trajectory there.
There is a trajectory, although, and this is a very important point, Hasidism can't be reduced to one particular set of ideas. So, yes, there is a messianic strain within Hasidism.
Well, the Rebbes are almost messianic, too.
They are almost messianic, but they do not necessarily function as messiahs. That is, they don't necessarily call for the Jews to return to the land of Israel, to rebuild the temple, reestablish the kingdom of David. In most cases, they function kind of as, you might call them, local messiahs. There are also very powerful traditions in Hasidism that are anti-messianic, that do not actually want to see the messianic age brought about by human beings. Schneerson was unique in this in many ways, in promoting a kind of messianic movement. And so people get the impression from looking at him that all of Hasidism has that view, which they don't.
Aren't there also Hasidic Jews who are pretty strongly opposed to the state of Israel?
Absolutely. And in fact, some of the main opposition to Zionism when it emerged in the late in 1897 with Theodor Herzl, some of the most vociferous opponents of Hasidism, of Zionism, were Hasidic leaders. They regarded it as a kind of, not just as secularism, but as something even worse than secularism. And so that opposition continues to this day. Satmar, for example, is rabidly anti-Zionist. Chabad less so.
Were the Satmars the one who went to spend time with Ahmadinejad?
There were some Satmar Hasidim who did that, yes.
Let me get another caller on here, and that's Kathleen. Good morning.
Good morning. I have just a couple of questions. I understand that what he said previously, they're not very much engaged in the business world, and there is just some that are. So how do they draw on their money, and how do they support these large families, and are they part of our social structure here? And if they are, how do they compare with other ethnic groups or other groups in relationship to the financial impact? And it's interesting that they supported Trump when he doesn't really support that kind of a situation.
Yeah, those are really good questions. You know, we tried to get into this in the book, but it turns out that it still requires a lot of research to try to understand how their economy works. They have a kind of an internal economy. For example, most of them are on food stamps. But they use the food stamps as a form of internal currency. And so they're able to use them, in place of dollars to buy and sell. So there is an internal economy that's actually quite robust.
And as you alluded to before, they have a lot of prominence in the Diamond District.
They do. They do. And there are various industries. I mean, people who have bought from 47th Street Electronics, you know, that's also controlled by Hasidim. So they're not absent from the modern economy. They do take part. They also have local, stores and so forth. In America, they tend to be, as I said before, much more present in the economy than they are in Israel. In Israel, because of the social welfare system, which is different from in the United States, actually much stronger, the safety net is much stronger there. For example, support for families with large families with a lot of children. There, they tend to be less present in the economy. Now, to come back to your question about Trump, there are a lot of contradictions here. It's also very interesting that they voted heavily for Trump, even though many of the Hasidic groups are anti-Zionist. And so his support for the state of Israel is not something that they necessarily would sign on to. But among among the various Hasidic groups, there are some who are supportive of the State of Israel, and that probably motivated their vote for him.
And Kathleen, we thank you for the question. You can't resist inserting it, talking about the Diamond District and Hasids. John Stewart, one of the first jokes he told, I don't know if you know about this, was all the Hasidim were leaving the Diamond District to get home for Shabbat, and there was a lot of traffic, and he said they called it Yidlock, which is pretty funny when you think about it, except for the fact that he said he told that joke in a bar, and people didn't understand it. He was in a bar in New Jersey.
I mean, actually, the way they – a lot of those people live in these upstate communities – they ride what are called the Muncie buses, and you can see them in New York. I mean, they're fleets of buses that carry these people back and forth. I don't think they're the main contributors to the gridlock.
Well, we were talking about the film One of Us, which you were an advisor on, and here's a listener named Michelle who wants to know if you saw the new movie Disobedience about the love affair between two women in a Hasidic community in London. It powerfully, she writes, shows the strength of the community as well as take seriously the women's desire and pleasure. I wonder if your guests can comment on the idea of same-sex desire and sexual pleasure, especially in the materialist tradition that he mentioned.
Yeah, really great questions. And I have not actually seen that film yet.
I did see it, by the way. I'll reserve comment, except that it takes very seriously the sense of women wanting to have erotic love with each other, same-sex love and so forth, and shows that, for the most part, it's not acceptable in the world of Hasids.
Yes, it's actually really interesting that in the film One of Us, one of the stories that's told there, a woman named Etty, who accuses her husband of abusing her. Actually, there's an aspect to the story they did not tell there, and that is that she actually developed a lesbian relationship. And you're quite right that the community, even though in Jewish law lesbianism is not forbidden, interestingly enough, gay sex, homosexuality is forbidden, but lesbianism is not. But the communities see this as a kind of challenge to the patriarchal family structure. And so yes, that would be something they would resist.
Let me just add that Israel, along with the United States, has one of the most open legal systems with respect to gay, lesbian relationships. But the Hasids are, again, a different category. I've actually got a caller here who's on point. And welcome, Daniel. Good morning.
Yes, hi. I am actually still a committed Novavitcher in many ways. I attend shul at the Chabad of Noe Valley, and but at the same time, as an out gay observant Jewish person, it's very hard in the world to sphere to find acceptance. My rabbi here in San Francisco is very unusual in that I'm one of six openly gay members of his shul. But back in New York, where I learned as a yeshiva bucker for many years, the attitude was often quite backwards.
How do you think that affects you to this day, Daniel? It would seem to me to be, since you were a bucker, as you said, which means a boy, and experienced this, probably stays with you for a lifetime, doesn't it?
Well, I had a whole earful of a rabbi recently telling me that my evil inclination had possessed me, and that how is this going to look when Mashiach arrives? But the attitude in the Bay Area to me is very, very different than it is on the East Coast with Orthodoxy.
Yeah. Imagine it's like night and day, or like two sides of the moon.
I think that's true. I mean, you're probably familiar, Daniel, with the documentary film "Trembling Before God." It's a really, I think, outstanding examination of what it's like to be gay in the ultra-Orthodox world, and it is extremely difficult, as you've just told us. One of the things that we learned in our study is that there are all kinds of things that go on within the Hasidic world that they would like to deny, but they are there, and including people who are gay, who have these kind of relationships and try to somehow reconcile them with the practices of their community. It's very, very difficult, but there are a lot of things that going on in the at the margins. People who live a double life, actually, whether or not they're gay. They are secular at night. They go out to a nightclub, and then during the day they put on the full garb, and they are back in the community. And
this is the black community. They call it going in the download. Let me thank Daniel for his call and actually go to a question from a listener named Denise, who says, it's my understanding that Hasid women shave their heads and then wear wigs. I've always wondered why. I presumed it was so as to avoid vanity, but if that's the case, doesn't the wig defeat the purpose?
Interesting point. Yes, it's not true of all Hasidic groups that the women shave their head when they become married. In some cases, they clip their hair short. And even the wearing of the wig is not consistent across all Hasidic groups. Some of them treat the wig, as you say, as something that is actually not, you know, it basically replicates the hair. And so if the idea behind the hair of a married woman is that she can attract other men, what good does the wig do? And so some of the most extreme groups, like the Toldot Aharon group in Jerusalem, there the women shave their heads and wear a black scarf. But there are other groups where, in fact, yes, they do wear this wig.
Some of the more, I suppose you call it religious groups are taking a kind of veils with women now. I've been reading almost burqas, almost like
there are some kind of offshoots. I would call them outliers. Yeah. They are not exactly Hasidic, but they may derive from Hasidic groups, which are experimenting with, full on burqas. This is not something you see in the Hasidic world generally, and these are, I want to emphasize, kind of outlier groups.
You also emphasized before the divorce process that you can go through within the Hasidic community, even though it's obviously to some extent frowned upon depending what the circumstances are, but you have to go through a get, don't you?
You do. That is a legal document. It's a legal document that gives a woman the right to remarry. And it's well established in Jewish law going back a couple thousand years. I think what is not entirely understood is that in situations where the man refuses to give the get and there is evidence of domestic abuse, the rabbis will usually step in and will force him to give the get. And there have been a number of cases of this sort. In the state of Israel, they actually use the secular authorities and they imprison people who will not give a get until they give it. So this whole question of marriage and divorce, very different from other kinds of fundamentalist groups.
We're talking with David Beal. He's the co-author of Hasidism, A New History, put out by Princeton University Press. He's professor of Jewish history and director of the Jewish Studies Program at UC Davis. And Zach joins us from Oakland. Zach, welcome.
Hi, Michael. I just want to say thank you so much for your shows over the years. You've been such an inspiration. So I actually went to New York for the first time a few weeks ago, and I was in Williamsburg. And the air raid siren went off. I was like, oh, my God, what's going on? And I realized it was for the Sabbath. So if you could just talk a bit about the history. And the other thing is, I just want to put in this comment. As an out queer individual, definitely was perceived a little bit coldly by a lot of the Hasidic Jews, but it was a really interesting culture. Thank you so much.
Thank you for the call. David Beal.
Yeah, so what's really interesting is that these communities, because they've become so large as a result of natural increase, they are able to establish themselves, for example, in Williamsburg as the dominant presence. Williamsburg is very interesting because it's sort of half Hasidic and half hipsters. But the Hasidim have, this is a Satmar community in Williamsburg, primarily Satmar. Yoel Teitelbaum, the founder of Satmar back in Hungary in the early 1920s, when he comes to New York, he tells his followers, buy real estate. That turned out to be a brilliant advice, because they actually control a very large community there, and they are able to enforce their particular practices on the community. Hence, for example, an air raid siren that would tell you when the Sabbath is starting. And this is also true of some of these communities they've established in upstate New York, which begin to resemble the shtetl of Eastern Europe, that is, communities that are heavily Jewish and that are heavily traditional in their practice.
Practical question, though, how do they determine if there's a real bombing for an air raid siren?
Good question.
From the fact that it's Shabbos. Sorry, I don't mean to make light of this, but it is a practice. Here's a listener who writes, "The idea that God is in everything is surely a lovely one. How could such a simple, singular idea get manifest in such strict rules and traditions?"
Well, now that the listener has put his or her finger on a crucial issue, and that is Hasidism, on the one hand, can be understood as a kind of a revolutionary movement. That is, that it puts in the hands of the average person the ability to unite with God in kind of ecstatic vision. On the other hand, Hasidism in the 19th century becomes more and more a bulwark of orthodoxy. That is a very traditional practice. In fact, we call it not traditional, but traditionalist. That is, the way in which they live becomes, at least in their view, the way Jews have always lived, even though that may not necessarily be true.
Preservation, really.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And that is in response to the modern world, that they developed this traditionalist attitude.
We're out of time, but it's been really a very informative hour, and I thank you for it. Appreciate your being with us. And the book, again, is Hasidism, A New History, by David Beal and a number of other scholars. He's professor of Jewish history and director of the Jewish Studies Program at UC Davis. And I thank you, our listeners, for being with us this morning on Forum. We'll be back with you on the morrow, if all goes according to plan. And in this hour, we're going to talk about a new play at the Marin Theater Company is producing, and also about the Pony Express and its history. Should be a fascinating hour as well. Thank you for being a part again. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.